Hi, everybody. Thank you for being here. This is a topic that isn't so pleasant to listen to some of the time. So I'm curious just to know, if you could just raise your hands and let me know, how many of you are researchers? Okay. And how many of you do policy-related work or make policy, influence policy? Okay. So I'm going to take this discussion in a little bit of a different direction and look at some of the kind of policy questions that come up for me. And I'm going to pose a lot of questions more than I'm going to offer answers, because these are the kinds of questions that I'm constantly grappling with and kind of keep me up at night, and I'm going to share some of them with you and also see if we can get a little bit of feedback from the other presenters about their thinking about how their research can translate to sound policy. And I actually want to pose a question and just hear briefly from each of you, Kristen and Elizabeth. How have your studies been received? How has your state, how has the federal government responded? Because that's really going to lead us, I think, down a path of kind of talking about what we can do in terms of policy.
So that's easy for me to answer. I don't think my research has had any effect. It certainly has not in my state, and I don't think that it has at a larger level. And part of that, I think, is because I haven't effectively targeted my findings to policymakers in my state. It's actually a question I was asked in Australia recently when I was over there presenting. They said, well, you know, what have you done for the U.S.? And the answer was nothing in terms of the effects that I'm having. So, yeah, I haven't figured out how to translate. I'm so delighted to see so many hands raised when Elisa asked how many policy makers, policy analysts were in the audience, because that's probably the largest number that has heard anything that I've had anything to do with.
It's been a very interesting situation in New Jersey. The federal government was very supportive of our findings, certainly promoted the findings. The state, unfortunately, was not as supportive, if I can say that. We began reaching out to the governor's office early on when we saw that our research was indicating that there was no reduction in sex crimes consistent with Megan's Law implementation, and ultimately we got no response. We got no response for many months until our final warning that our deadline was fast approaching to NIJ and that the findings would become public. And when that occurred, we were told we could give interviews, and the Associated Press was the first interview, at which point it was then picked up by many, many newspaper articles, and it just kind of became a firestorm in the state, and at the same time, everything sort of exploded, and Maureen Kanka came out with a statement, and state senators came out with statements, and then the governor at that time immediately issued a statement within days saying that Megan's Law would never be changed and that no study would have an effect on changing the policy. I can't imagine that, given the sort of political background of our new governor, that we'll see much of a change consistent with that either. So unfortunately, that's the case.
I'm also thinking about it in terms of timing. The Adam Walsh Act, with the Title I, which is the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act, that is mandating to all 50 states, 197 Indian tribes, and the 5 U.S. territories, how to create a uniform system for public notification, and as Elizabeth was discussing, how to tier offenders based on offense, not based on assessed risk and so forth. So that was passed in 2006. We're coming up on a deadline of the final deadline of July 2011 for the implementation of SORNA. In the meantime, these studies have come out, several other studies have come out, and I've just been thinking about how this kind of information does either get kind of sidelined or ignored, because we now have a major federal project on our hands of implementing SORNA, which essentially is going against what the data tells us is, in fact, effective. And we see this around sex offender management policy, community management of sex offenders, that kind of policy. We see this all the time, that policymakers essentially often find themselves in a dilemma. We're seeing more and more research that's showing that a lot of the things that we are turning into policy, that we're seeing be turned into policy, are not effective, residence restrictions being the other significant way that sex offenders are managed when they return to communities. So, we have to think about what is compelling compelling policymakers to legislate in these ways when data is telling them otherwise. So one of the things we do know, and this is, something for all of you researchers to think about, certainly, but also the policymakers here, we do know from a lot of research, ironically enough, that policymakers don't make decisions based, I'm saying something fairly obvious, I guess, based on research. The decisions that are made about laws that are implemented, especially around things that are very emotional, very painful for communities, individuals, families to grapple with, they're not making decisions necessarily based on what research tells us. So one of the things we need to be thinking about is how can research play a more influential role in influencing policy, and how can we provide policymakers, this is the slightly more complex piece of this, how can we provide policymakers with the kind of cover that they need to make the decisions that might not be perceived as popular when it comes to sex offender-related policy. We know that sex crime issues have little to do for people with facts and research, so we're talking about kind of communities. Common sense says if you want to protect kids from predators, you need to know where they are, thus community notification. Thus residence restrictions. If we just move them away from where children congregate, we can protect them. It seems to make sense. And the terms that are used, don't sound so bad. And so one of the things policymakers need to be thinking about is how do you change or reframe those terms and the concepts behind them? And then another very interesting piece of this community notification discussion is again, what the public thinks about it. The Washington State Institute for Public Policy did some interesting research in 1998. They did, just in Washington, in the state of Washington, they asked people about their perceptions of community notification. And what they found was that almost 75% of respondents reported that they learned more about sex offenders, sex offenses, how sex offenders operate because of community notification. Their awareness was raised, and over 60% said that community notification makes released sex offenders behave better. So they had a sense that it actually would influence sex offenders to feel like they're being watched, people know who they are, so they're going to be less likely to reoffend. And the vast majority, and I can't remember what the exact percentage is, I think it was in the high 80s, felt safer knowing about convicted sex offenders living in their communities, and they indicated that they were more safety conscious, they took precautions, that kind of thing. The question here is, are policymakers making these decisions based on what they think the public wants to hear? If so, how do we educate the public properly? And then how do we get the policies to shift based on research, of course? And then one of the things that just has come up for me in listening to these two folks or reading their material is, all of the policies historically since the early 90s that have legislated these registration notification laws have been named after three different children, nationally known situations of extreme, deep pain of children who have been abducted, have never been recovered. In one case, we know Megan Kanko was, in fact, raped before she was killed. Adam Walsh was never found. We don't know what happened to him. Jacob Wetterling was never found. These are the three children upon which federal policy has been set around community notification. And so I just pose this question, does this make it psychologically difficult for anyone to oppose or question these policies because somehow it might be detracting from the pain, the very real pain that we all feel around what has happened to these particular kids. Is it an affront to the families, the bereaved families? I also am struck by something that isn't talked about quite as much when we talk about notification laws, sex offender registration and notification laws, and that is this difference between reportage and incidence. So one of the things that some of us that do this work have a sense of is that the policies that we're increasingly legislating around sex offenders returning to communities are policies that may be having a deep influence on the decision to report, to bring to light situations of child sexual abuse and adult sexual assault. We know that the vast majority of sexual violence is perpetrated within intimate circles, communities. With child sexual abuse, 93% is perpetrated by someone known to the victim. About, 35% is actual family members of the victim. And with adult sexual assault, it's about 64% of women we know have been raped, physically assaulted, or stalked by an intimate partner. So we know that this is a crime that is perpetrated within intimate circles. And the reportage rates are kind of in keeping with those statistics. We know that only about 12% of child sexual abuse is ever reported to the authorities. Only about 16% of rapes, 20% is what Jaden and Thones tell us. So with sexual violence happening in these intimate circles, are we somehow with these laws keeping people from feeling like they want to bring forward these members of their families, their communities, to are we somehow keeping situations underground? Let's see. And the last thing that I wanted to bring up is something that these two studies that we heard about don't focus on, but that is particularly significant are the unintended consequences that are associated with community public notification on sex offenders. We know that sex offenders returning to communities who are publicly notified upon suffer from loss of jobs and unemployment, employment instability. They suffer often from harassment and physical assault. They have chronic difficulties finding places to live, finding jobs, and they're frequently forced to the outskirts of communities into increasingly rural areas where they're not going to be able to access the kind of specialized supervision and services that they may need to not reoffend. These kinds of stressors on sex offenders' lives are shown to actually raise their risk for recidivating. We know from the general criminogenic literature and we know from the sex offender-specific research that when sex offenders have stable jobs, housing, social bonds to the community in which they live, and they are able to continue their family relationships, they're going to be less likely to reoffend. So certainly for policymakers, we need to be thinking about those kinds of questions. You know, what are the unintended consequences? What are the collateral consequences of the decisions we're making, especially when they're not based on the research that we're seeing? So that is what I wanted to share, and I know that we're all open for questions now.
Please join me in thanking the panel.